Hello, and welcome to the History of Rome. Episode 161, The Swamps of Ravenna. It wouldn't be fair to come down too hard on the successors of Theodosius for their failure to maintain even a semblance of cooperation between the eastern and western halves of the empire. After all, as two civil wars fully attested, it's not like Theodosius's reign had been a shiny beacon of collegiality. But still, as the year 400 dawned, it was clear that the leaders of the empire were simply not up to the task of maintaining imperial unity. In survey history books, the year 395 is often labeled as the year when the two halves of the empire became legally separate entities, when they split into being constitutionally independent political apparatuses. And though that is technically inaccurate, as a matter of understanding the transformations of late antiquity, I would say that, sure, that is more or less correct. From here on out, the East and West will act as rivals and enemies at least as often as they act as friends and allies. Officially, of course, there never was a legal divorce, and right up until the bitter end, everyone paid lip service to a unified Rome. But unofficially, off the record, yeah, they've been living in separate houses for years. As the year 400 dawned, though, that unofficial official separation was still in its infancy, and there really was a reasonable hope that the growing rift might be bridged. And so Stilicho, dominant statesman and general of the West, focused a huge amount of time and effort trying to build that bridge, the keystone being himself, naturally. But in the end, he wound up spending so much time and effort on the project that he neglected like half the provinces that it was his sworn duty to protect. And this neglect eventually had catastrophic consequences, not just for Stilicho's own life and career, but for the Western Empire as a whole. For the moment, however, Stilicho was about as strong politically as any non-emperor had ever been. He had successfully parried the dangerous thrusts of Alaric and his Goths, and then quickly restored order in North Africa after Gildo revolted and cut off the grain supply. Meanwhile, his rivals in the East had been having a hell of a time staying in power, as ministers and generals picked each other off one by one in a series of palace coups. For a brief moment in 400, the ethnically Goth general Gainas was ascendant, but after he returned to Constantinople with an army mostly composed of his own countrymen, he discovered that the citizens of the capital were not too psyched about these barbarians occupying their city. After a series of escalating incidents, in midsummer, Constantinople broke out into a full-scale riot, forcing Gainas to pull his men out of the city and flee, leaving behind some 7,000 Goths who were cornered by the mob and ripped to pieces. Over the course of these riots, the imperial palace itself was, if not totally burned to the ground, at least heavily damaged by fire. Gainas fled north to the Danube, and after crossing the river, he sought out the most powerful of the Hunnic kings, a man named Olden, and attempted to forge an alliance. But Olden, who was in the process of methodically consolidating his domination over the lands north of the Danube, took the opportunity to make a showing of friendly good faith to the Romans, and he sent Gainas's head in a gift-wrapped box back to Constantinople. With the East in a semi-sort of disarray, and the Empress Eudoxia now standing as the only real political leader of consequence, Stilicho was about ready to start re-pushing his claim to regency over Arcadius. But he was sidetracked by a barbarian invasion, and then really sidetracked when Alaric and his Goths invaded Italy. As we've already seen, the Hunnic migration into the Danube region led to massive population shifts among the existing barbarian populations. This process got started, of course, when Fritigern and his Goths came knocking back in the 370s, but that was just the opening round. In 401, a combined force of Vandals and Alans, fleeing from Olden's aforementioned attempts to subjugate them, reached the borders of the Roman Empire in the provinces of Raetia and Noricum, and, deciding that they stood a much better chance fighting Romans than fighting Huns, just kept right on moving west. Stilicho marched up from Italy at once, and through his usual brand of deft maneuvering was able to turn this horde back, but his deployment of the Italian army north of the Alps meant that the home province was now wide open to any threat that might happen along. Cue Alaric. As soon as Stilicho advanced out of Italy, Alaric saw a golden opportunity to gain some much-needed political and military security. His elevation to an official position within the Roman army had never been popular, nor were the subsidies that fed his people, who were now settled in Illyria. When his patron Eutropius was toppled, Alaric knew that his position was now shaky at best. When the people of Constantinople successfully drove Gainas and his Goths out of the capital, Alaric could see the writing on the wall. Pretty soon the supplies would stop coming in, he would be stripped of his command, and then very possibly toppled from power by his own angry countrymen. So in late 401, Alaric decided to go on the offensive, move west, and try his luck at extracting concessions from Milan. It was a risky bet, because by crossing the Alps, Alaric was breaking his contract with Constantinople, so this was an all-or-nothing sort of play. He was preemptively burning his political bridges to the east. But while a risky bet, it was not necessarily a bad bet. With the bulk of the Western army engaged along the Upper Rhine, Alaric was able to enter Italy completely unchallenged, and then pretty much do whatever he wanted. The Gothic king initially got bogged down besieging the key fortress city of Aquileia, but he quickly and wisely gave that up and decided to turn his attention to lower-hanging fruit. For the rest of the winter, the Goths ran amok throughout northern Italy, while the Roman authorities could only look on helplessly. Honorius and his house guard at Milan could do nothing about Alaric, and Stilicho, his campaign against the Vandals et al. Pretty much wrapped up, was trapped on the wrong side of the snowed-in Alpine passes. As the spring of 402 approached, Alaric still had not gotten the concessions he wanted, and so he decided it was time to play his last card before things were complicated by Stilicho's return. He marched on Milan and laid siege to the capital city. Now, he never really had a hope in hell of taking Milan, but he wanted to spook the young emperor Honorius into authorizing subsidies to the Goths that would make up for the subsidies from Constantinople Alaric had given up by crossing the Alps. Honorius was indeed spooked and almost fled to Gaul, but he was convinced to sit tight and wait for Stilicho to come back and save the day. The emperor did not have to wait long. The minute the passes thawed out in March of 402, Stilicho was riding back into Italy at top speed to save the day, helpfully backed by an even stronger army than he had left with. Knowing that he would immediately be engaging the Goths upon his return to Italy, Stilicho had ensured that part of the settlements of the previous year included barbarian troops promising to enroll as auxiliaries in the Roman army. When this even stronger Roman army entered Italy, the disappointed Alaric was forced to withdraw from Milan, having gained no concessions from the Western court. Alaric and Stilicho then picked up where they had left off and proceeded to dance around each other in the countryside southwest of the capital. But unlike their two previous encounters, this time they would actually meet in battle. On Easter Sunday, Stilicho attacked the Goths near Pollentia, a city a little east of modern Torino. The timing of the attack was a bit scandalous, as it was understood by all sides that Easter was a holy day, and not a day for fighting. But Stilicho did not want to squander an opportunity. However, being a devout Christian himself, Stilicho was wary of leading the attack personally, so he put an ethnically Alan and religiously pagan general in charge of the assault. The pagan barbarian general, as you can imagine, had no qualms about attacking on Easter Sunday, and the regular soldiers under his command, flush with the victory of the previous year, seemed eager to continue stomping the enemies of Rome, Easter Sunday or no. The Goths were taken by surprise, and after some fierce fighting, they were forced to make a run for it up into the mountains, losing control of their baggage train along the way. Stilicho opened negotiations with the treed Alaric, and in exchange for the Gothic king withdrawing from Italy for good, the Goths appear to have been granted some limited subsidies, and Alaric was allowed to maintain an official Roman command, this one bestowed by Milan rather than Constantinople. In the early summer of 402, Alaric then led his people on a slow march east back toward Illyria. And not to get off on too far of a tangent, but I have seen it noted a few places that this all took place in June of 403, a full year after the Battle of Pollentia, but in other places that it all took place in June of 402. Since the 402 date makes way, way more sense, that's the chronology I'm going with, because otherwise we'd have to explain why Alaric and his defeated army just sort of sat around in the mountains for 14 months. On his way back east, though, Alaric inexplicably decided to halt his march and make camp near Verona. There are a few different theories about why Alaric stopped, but all of them are purely speculative. He wanted to regain his honor by defeating Stilicho in a rematch battle. He wanted to try to cut a better deal with the Western court. He knew that having broken his pact with Constantinople, that there was a very good chance he was going to be attacked by the Eastern legions when he showed his face there again. Maybe it was a bit of all of these things, and maybe it was something else entirely. Whatever the reason, Stilicho apparently decided that enough was enough. It was time to crush Alaric once and for all. Potential asset or no, the Gothic king was proving to be way more trouble than he was worth. We have almost no details about the subsequent Battle of Verona, except that it turned out to be probably the worst defeat in Alaric's long and illustrious career. Stilicho's victory was so complete that a significant element of the Gothic high command defected to the Roman side in the aftermath of the battle. The most important of these defections was, of course, that of Sarus, a bitter rival of Alaric's, who would become a key ally of Stilicho's and then play a major role in the events surrounding the sack of Rome in 410. But noticeably absent from the victory was Alaric's head on a pike. The wily barbarian king had taken flight when the battle became clearly lost and was now racing headlong for the Alps. Those in his army who did not defect raced after him. The chattering classes could not help but notice that once again Stilicho had let Alaric escape with his life. Probably the most important legacy of the brief Gothic invasion of Italy was Stilicho's decision to move the seat of Western imperial power from Milan to Ravenna. Though Alaric had never truly threatened Milan, his advance on the capital had proven that the city was vulnerable to attack. What would happen the next time an enemy decided to invade Italy while the Western legions were occupied elsewhere? Given the times, this was not a hypothetical question. It was a very real strategic dilemma. Milan may have been heavily fortified, but it was still easily approachable. Ravenna, on the other hand, was surrounded by a ring of dense marshlands that rendered any overland approach a logistical nightmare. Hidden away behind these swamps, the Western emperors would now be safe from the inevitable enemy invasions that Stilicho could see looming on the horizon. The move to Ravenna is a depressing reminder of how far the empire has fallen. When Rome was at its height, no one thought twice about the capital being located in, well, Rome, which was stuck inconveniently down some random peninsula. No threat was so great, no enemy so dangerous, that the extra time and energy it took to run the empire from Rome really factored into anyone's thinking. With the arrival of the crisis of the 3rd century, though, that extra time and energy began to loom large, and the imperial court was moved to Milan, which put the emperors on the front line and allowed them to move quickly from crisis point to crisis point. The move to Milan was an admission that the Golden Age was dead and gone, but at least it was an aggressive response to an extremely difficult situation. The move to Ravenna, however, was an admission that the empire was becoming helpless. Its emperors no longer commanded the world from a recliner on the Palatine Hill, nor did they sit perched atop the walls of Milan, armor donned, ready to spring into action. No, instead they now cowered behind a ring of marshes, play-acting as if they really still were the kings of the world. It made sense strategically for Stilicho to tuck Honorius away in a safe little pocket given the limited resources at his disposal, but still, oh, how the mighty have fallen. At around the same time, it appears that Stilicho made another key decision, that while making perfect sense given the geopolitical realities he was facing, would have profound consequences for the empire. Since the foundation of the Tetrarchy, the Roman capital of the Gallic frontier had always been Trier, located along the lower Rhine. But at some point in the early 5th century, the capital was shifted some 500 kilometers south to the city of Lyon. This shortened the supply and communication lines between the imperial court and its Gallic satellite, which was necessary given the insecurity of the Rhine frontier, but it was also a clear signal that Rome was repositioning itself for a tighter defense of the inner empire at the expense of its northern territories. The citizens of Britain and the lower Rhine were now basically on their own, and it would not take them long to wake up to the fact that they were still paying taxes to an empire that had given up trying to protect them. The main beneficiaries of this withdrawal turned out to be the Franks. Going back to the days of Constantine, the Franks had slowly but steadily migrated and settled their way into becoming the dominant political and military force along the lower Rhine. Their territory straddled both sides of the river, and as the emperors of Rome dealt with difficulties elsewhere, it became convenient to sign treaties with the Frankish kings, granting them de facto independence in exchange for a promise to defend the frontier from other barbarian groups. When the Roman authorities began to withdraw from the north, the local landed nobility was understandably worried about what this meant for them, and so they too turned to the Franks, cutting deals with them to protect the nobility's property in exchange for food and cash. This alliance between the increasingly non-Roman-aligned nobility of northern Gaul and the increasingly disinterested and ever-becoming Romanized Franks would form the backbone of the Frankish kingdom that would one day rename Gaul and give us Charlemagne. But that is still an upheaval or two away, so let's get back to what happened next. In late 405, perhaps a bit sooner than Stilicho would have hoped, one of those inevitable invasions of Italy inevitably came crashing down into Italy. The man behind the invasion was a new player on the board, but he was driven by what should now be a familiar reason, the continued expansion of the Huns. Said new player was a Gothic king named Radagaisus, who ruled the pagan Goths who still lived on the north side of the Danube River. He had managed to hold his own against the Huns thus far, but Olden's push to subjugate all local nations to the Huns finally became intolerable, and Radagaisus led his people across the Danube into Roman territory and then into Italy itself. Exaggerated sources sometimes claim the total number of Goths under Radagaisus' leadership was some 400,000 men, women, and children, but modern estimates figure it was more like 100,000, with about 20,000 men in fighting shape. Radagaisus' lightning invasion just before the onset of winter took Stilicho off guard, and he was forced to sit tight for months until the spring allowed necessary reinforcements to arrive from Gaul. In the meantime, Radagaisus divided his followers into three groups and set them to plundering. Now, this was a reasonable idea, given that having all those mouths to feed in the same place at the same time was a liability, but come the spring of 406, when Stilicho was reinforced, having the Gothic forces divided turned out to be the biggest liability of all. Backed by troops from the Rhine frontier, as well as Hun forces sent with the compliments of Olden, who not only wanted to continue courting the friendship of the Romans, but also wanted to send a message that you couldn't run from the Huns, Stilicho moved directly against the division of the Goths, led by Radagaisus himself. The Gothic king was engaged in a nearly successful siege of Florence when Stilicho arrived on the scene. The Goths, taken by surprise, were dispersed and unprepared, and so the Romans were able to easily scatter them. So easily, in fact, that it is reported that not a drop of Roman blood was spilled. Radagaisus and his people fled up into the Apennines, where, though safe from further attack, they were trapped and cut off from their compatriots. Pretty soon the Goths were in dire straits, and Radagaisus, either selfishly trying to escape or selflessly trying to make contact with the other two groups, was captured trying to make a run for it. He was brought before Stilicho, who had the Goth king executed without delay. The rest of the trapped Goths simply gave up. When the news that Radagaisus was dead and his warriors captured reached the other two groups, they too simply gave up the fight and surrendered to Roman forces. About 12,000 of the best Gothic fighters were promptly enrolled into the Roman army, while the rest were sold into slavery, collapsing the slave market in the process. Anyone left over headed back from whence they had come, most likely dreading the reception Olden had planned for them. Though circumstances never seemed to allow Stilicho to immediately deal with these invasions into Italy, no one could deny that when he finally was able to act, that he brought a swift conclusion to the crisis. In August of 406, then, Stilicho was at the high water mark of his career, twice now the savior of Italy, and he took the political capital he had earned and decided to spend it on his long-standing pet project of unifying the East and West under his personal control. The claims to regency over Arcadius were now a bit absurd. After all, the emperor was now in his late 20s, but that did not stop Stilicho from pressing for territorial concessions from Constantinople. Specifically, he demanded the return of the eastern half of Illyria, which, as you'll recall, had been ceded over to the east to create a unified theater of command for Theodosius right after the Battle of Adrianople. Stilicho thought it right and proper that it be returned to the purview of the Western Augustus immediately. His saber rattling on the issue included a threat to go to war to protect Honorius's claim to the territory, and possibly messages sent to Alaric pressing the Gothic king to once again go out a plundering in Thrace. But all this saber-rattling was brought to a dramatic halt on New Year's Eve 406. Remember those Vandals and Alans who had been stopped in 401? Well, they were back on the move, this time joined by Burgundians and Alemanni. On the last day of 406, they crashed through the line that had been weakened when Stilicho brought down troops to deal with Radagaisus. Unpacified barbarians were now spilling across the border. Next week, we will deal with the deep consequences of this invasion. For starters, no, they never will be turned back. These Vandals are the same Vandals who will eventually wind their way down into North Africa and set up an independent kingdom for themselves. But more immediately, the invasion will lead to the complete political breakdown of the Northwestern Empire. Revolts and counter-revolts will lead to havoc far beyond the presence of a few barbarians, most dramatically demonstrated by the Roman withdrawal from Britain in 410. The end times are upon us, and the walls are crumbling down. Hello, and welcome to the History of Rome, Episode 162, Opening the Floodgates. On New Year's Eve 406 AD, a massive horde of barbarians crashed across the Lower Rhine and began spilling into the interior of the Roman Empire. The mixed group included Vandals, Alans, Burgundians, and Alemanni, and their combined strength overwhelmed the local Roman defenses. Well, local Roman defenses isn't entirely accurate. For the most part, the legions proper had been pulled south, either to bolster the defenses of the Upper Rhine or to augment Stilicho's Italian army as he faced off against Radagaisus' invading Goths. The northern section of the frontier was thus protected only by the allied Franks. The Franks fought hard to stop the invasion. After all, the Lower Rhine was now as much their territory as it was the Romans, but they were simply unable to hold the line. So the hordes poured in, and when they did, they triggered a series of upheavals that completely remade the political map of the Western Empire. Stilicho, as I mentioned at the end of last week, got this news while he was in the middle of rattling his saber at Constantinople and demanding the return of Illyria to the Western sphere of influence. Sitting at the head of an army that had been reinforced by troops from the Rhine and some 12,000 Gothic warriors from Radagaisus' group, Stilicho was feeling pretty confident about his military position and wanted to press home his advantage. Now, there are some good long-term reasons for Stilicho being so obsessed with the return of Illyria. For starters, it was the gateway to Italy, and with Constantinople showing little interest in using its resources to defend the eastern ends of the Alpine passes, the leaders of the Western court needed to take matters into their own hands. Beyond that was the fact that Illyria was a prime recruiting ground for soldiers. Stilicho had taken a lot of flack from the Senate for his reliance on barbarian mercenaries, but at the same time, they had consistently resisted all efforts to draft young men from their estates into service. So Illyria promised to be a nice answer to the conundrum. But though these were noble and legitimate reasons for Stilicho's eastern focus, there was no escaping the fact that the decision to use his newly enlarged army as a political tool to menace Constantinople necessarily meant leaving the northern Rhine frontier dangerously under-garrisoned. Though the particulars are different, this all reminds me a great deal of the Empire round about 260, when Gallienus chose to prioritize the Danube frontier over the Rhine frontier. Rather than playing the role of Posthumus and adopting a purely Western-centric political and military posture, Stilicho instead decided to play the role of Gallienus, turn his attention east, and essentially leave Gaul to its fate. The Romans had defeated Radagaisus in August of 406, which left Stilicho plenty of time to send the Rhine legions back north, possibly even reinforced by the new Gothic recruits before winter set in. But he was so intent on the east that he kept his forces united in Italy. Gaul was overwhelmed by invading barbarians, permanently, I might add, just 6 months later. Then again, Italy had been invaded twice in the last 5 years, so Stilicho's decision to focus on his eastern flank rather than his northern flank is somewhat understandable. But in choosing to follow Gallienus' lead, Stilicho all but guaranteed that someone would step in to play the role of Posthumus. And as soon as the barbarians crossed into Gaul, that someone stepped up. Right on cue, Flavius Claudius Constantius, the senior commander on the island of Britain, and the man history will come to know as Constantine III, was hailed as Augustus by his troops in early 407. So now the West was not just under attack, it was in revolt. Super. Constantine III was in no way related to his namesake, nor was he related in any way to any existing noble family. He was a common soldier who had risen up through the ranks, and he attained his senior command by way of a military coup. The Roman occupation of Britain was gasping its last in the early 400s, and one of the symptoms of its fatal affliction was a breakdown in the solidarity of the occupying forces themselves. In 406, a series of coups and counter-coups threw up and then threw out senior generals at a frightening clip. When the invasion of Gaul began, a man named Gratian, about whom we know nothing, happened to be in charge. As the reports came in describing the barbarian flood, Gratian hesitated over whether to respond, irking the patriotic Roman element of the British army, who wanted to immediately cross over to Gaul and help turn back the hordes. Ambitious and capable, Constantine exploited Gratian's inaction, promised that if he were in charge, they would have sailed for Gaul yesterday, and then successfully ousted Gratian from power. Good to his word, after being hailed as Augustus, Constantine gathered up all the mobile Roman forces on the island, put them on ships, and sailed them for Gaul. To which the people of Britain said, "Wait, what now? All of the Roman mobile forces? Can't you just..." But it was too late. The Romano-British citizens could only watch them go. "Okay, but, what about us? Hello? Are you leaving for good, or what? Hello?" As soon as he arrived in northern Gaul, Constantine set about winning the loyalty of every Roman garrison in the area. Glad just to have someone around who seemed interested in doing something about the barbarians, the local troops were easily won over, and pretty soon Constantine had a decent-sized force behind him. But though his army was growing, it was still in no shape to head off into battle just yet, and so the invading barbarians were free to roam northern Gaul unimpeded. They sacked city after city, including the fairly important city of Mainz, before turning their attention to Trier itself. But the old capital of Gaul was too heavily fortified, and after a bitter but unsuccessful siege, the barbarians peeled off in search of easier targets. Constantine, meanwhile, identified an isolated group of Saxons as a good place to start his campaign, and attack them as soon as his army was ready to fight. Though the battle itself couldn't have been more than a glorified skirmish, when Constantine defeated the Saxons, it was a huge propaganda boon to his cause. To the citizens of Gaul, and eventually Spain, Constantine became a man worthy of their loyalty and their taxes, unlike those imperial do-nothings down in Ravenna, who sucked them dry and then left them to die. Stilicho's response to the invasion of Gaul was clearly not all that it should have been. But in his defense, I would like to note that he was up against one of the all-time great obstacles to adequate responses, lack of information. With winter raging and the local Gallic ministry now headquartered down in Lyon, dispatches from the northern front were few, and the descriptions they contained were vague. "Oh, by the way, some barbarians have crossed over the Rhine, and you should probably send reinforcements." But a hostile tribe crossing the Rhine was a regular event these days, and everyone always wanted reinforcements. Given his immediate reaction to the crisis, and then his later reaction when spring came and much more detailed reports came in, it is difficult to conclude that Stilicho thought something huge was underway in Gaul, and simply chose to ignore it. Because, though he had spent the winter positioning his army for a potential war with Constantinople, even after reports of the invasion had come down, as soon as spring came and Stilicho discovered how bad things really were, he wheeled them around and pointed them toward Gaul. Unfortunately for everyone, Stilicho's only immediate response to the crisis was to send a group of allied Vandals who had been settled in Pannonia up into Gaul to reinforce the local defenses. You can imagine the reaction of the leaders of Trier when this new horde of Vandals showed up on their doorstep, claiming that Stilicho had sent them, and let us in because we're hungry. I wouldn't believe that line in a million years, not after I had just spent a week fighting tooth and nail against some other horde of Vandals. So these reinforcements were predictably denied access to the city. But without supplies of their own, the allied Vandals did the only thing they could think of to survive. They had joined in the plundering. Stilicho's reinforcements thus wound up reinforcing only the enemy. Whoops. Come the spring of 407, the lines of communication thawed out, and the full extent of the chaos became apparent to the court of Ravenna. But if you thought hordes of barbarians running amok and a Roman general who claimed an imperial title trying to turn them back was chaotic, well, just wait, because the lines between those two are about to become super blurry. See, what we have here is not one monolithic barbarian horde, so much as dozens of smaller groups, all with independent motives swirling around in independent directions. In the middle of the swirl was Constantine and his regular Roman forces. He was aware that he had no hope of restoring order to Gaul solely by way of the sword, so Constantine opened negotiations with the various barbarian kings and chieftains. For their part, these barbarian leaders recognized that they would not have the upper hand forever, and that it might be better to deal with the Romans than fight them. After all, who wanted to be sent back east to face off against the Huns? So when Constantine's envoys came round saying that their general had assumed imperial title and was in a position to make a deal, they listened. Not all of them listened, but enough of them did that pretty soon Constantine's ranks were swelled by the very barbarians he had come down to fight. Having successfully co-opted swaths of the barbarians, Constantine was then further bolstered by the defection of most of the Spanish nobility to his cause. The self-proclaimed Augustus was, after all, the only thing standing between the remaining loose barbarians and Hispania. Down in Ravenna, then, Stilicho was left to sort through a very complicated mess. Over here you have barbarian intruders. Okay, they need to be fought off. Over there, you have Constantine fighting them off, but only after illegally donning the purple, and we can't have that. But over here, you have barbarians who have joined with Constantine and his Roman forces. Are they allies because they're fighting the unrepentant barbarian invaders, or are they enemies because they're fighting for an imperial usurper? In what order do you prioritize your response to all this? Stilicho surveyed the mess and ordered his priorities, and in the process sowed as many of the seeds of his own downfall as his enemies would ever need to take him down. Stilicho decided that the first priority would be Constantine. There is absolutely no way you can tolerate self-proclaimed emperors, so all of Stilicho's subsequent preparations were aimed at battle with the usurper rather than battle with the still loose barbarians. There was a practical element to the decision, as Constantine had moved south and taken control of Lyon. The majority of the loose barbarians were still running amok in northern Gaul, so Stilicho was going to have to go through Constantine to get to them anyway. Might as well settle family business along the way. But the senatorial aristocracy of Italy and southern Gaul was mortified at Stilicho's decision. The empire has been overrun by no good smelly barbarians, and you're going to use our precious military resources to attack the one guy who's actually been doing something about the invasion? This did not sit well at all. But that would not be the half of it. As Stilicho was remustering his army at the city of Pavia, just on the Italian side of the Alps, he sent word to Alaric that there would be no war with Constantinople that year, and that as such, the Gothic king's services would not be required. But the thing is that just a few months before, Stilicho had ordered Alaric to move south and occupy Epirus, a clear violation of a number of agreements between Ravenna, Constantinople, and the Goths, and it was a move clearly designed to set up Stilicho's crossing of the Adriatic. But now, it was just an extremely provocative maneuver that was just sort of hanging out there. Having footed the bill for, well, let's call it what it was, the invasion of Epirus, Alaric was less than enthused to hear that there would be no further campaign, because that meant there would be no further capture of booty to offset his expenditures. Plus, now he faced potential reprisals from the east for his unprovoked aggression. So Alaric sent a note back to Stilicho, demanding 4,000 pounds of gold to cover Gothic expenses. Now it was Stilicho's turn to be less than enthused, but Alaric had him over a barrel. The Italian army couldn't march on Gaul with hostile Goths threatening their rear, a fact that both sides could plainly see. So Stilicho recommended to the Senate that Alaric be paid. He was able to force the measure through, and the Senate approved the funds, but no one was very happy that a Vandal general was making them hand over gold to a Gothic king so that said Vandal general could go off and fight a Roman army currently engaged in operations against hostile barbarians. With his rear secured, Stilicho was finally able to launch a counterattack. But by then, the campaign season had drawn to a close, so everything was put on hold until early spring 408. As soon as the passes thawed out, though, the Italian army was marching north, led by Sarus, the Goth general who had defected to Rome following the Battle of Verona in 402. Stilicho, his political power eroding, stayed behind in Ravenna to ensure that his enemies did not get a hold of the easily manipulated Emperor Honorius. Sarus met an advance guard of Constantine's army almost the minute he crossed over the Alps, but after a fierce fight, Constantine's men were broken and driven off. Sarus followed this victory by pushing hard to the city of Valentia, where Constantine himself had taken up residence. Sarus besieged the city, but before he could capture the self-proclaimed Augustus and bring a swift end to this rebellion, reinforcements that Constantine had recruited from the Lower Rhine suddenly appeared and drove Sarus off. The timing of this relief army was excellent, but their arrival was more a matter of coincidence than anything else. Assembled to put down a nascent counter-revolution brewing in Spain, the troops just so happened to already be on the way south when Sarus began the siege of Valentia. And so Constantine wound up saved, and Sarus wound up driven off. Now outnumbered locally, Sarus deemed it prudent to withdraw back to Italy and regroup. But as his army approached the Alps, he discovered just how low the prestige of the Italian imperial regime had been laid. An armed and organized band of locals, part freedom fighters and part brigands, had occupied the passes after Sarus passed through the first time, and they were now demanding that the Romans pay a ransom for passage. Although Sarus probably could have forced the issue, the rebels were entrenched, and it would have cost time and resources that the Gothic general didn't have time to spare. So he paid the ransom and carried on. The optics of a Roman imperial army paying a toll to pass through their own backyard was terrible, and lost on exactly no one. In May of 408, Stilicho was preparing the troops for another invasion, this one to coincide with a Theodosian family-led uprising in Spain, that's the nascent counter-revolt I just mentioned, when a bombshell dropped in from the east. The Emperor Arcadius was dead. He was 30 or 31 years old and had been Emperor of the East for 13 years. I'm going to circle back around and cover the last few years worth of events in Constantinople next week, and for now, I'm just going to focus on the implications of Arcadius's death for the West, specifically the implications for Stilicho. The Vandal general had never gotten over his desire to control both halves of the empire, and Arcadius's death opened up what would probably be his last best chance to unite East and West under his personal control. The logical heir to the throne was Arcadius' seven-year-old son, Theodosius II. But with Honorius now the senior Augustus in the empire, Stilicho argued that the West ought to have some say in how the regime change played out. The last thing Stilicho needed was his enemies in Constantinople, of which there were legion at this point, dominating some new child emperor. Honorius was keen to travel himself to Constantinople and oversee the transition of power, but Stilicho was worried that Honorius too would fall under the sway of the Eastern ministers should he be allowed to leave Italy, and so, citing a number of convenient reasons, that the trip would cost too much, that it would leave Italy open to invasion from Constantine, Stilicho convinced Honorius to stay in Ravenna. Instead, he, Stilicho, would go and represent Honorius' interests. Now, this course of action was not without its own dangers. After all, while Stilicho was gone, his enemies back in Italy, of which there were also legion at this point, could worm their way into Honorius's ear and turn the emperor against him. But the opportunity to put his stamp on the imperial court of Constantinople proved too alluring, and in the summer of 408, Stilicho made preparations to leave. When Honorius and Stilicho parted ways in August, a devious minister and arch-foe of Stilicho's named Olympias swooped in and started spinning a treacherous tale to the emperor. Stilicho, he said, was not going to Constantinople to ensure that Honorius's interests would be protected. He was going to push aside young Theodosius II and install his own son, Eucharius, on the eastern throne. This was not necessarily an implausible accusation. After all, Eucharius, by way of Stilicho's wife Serena, was the lawful and acknowledged grandson of Theodosius the Great. No one these days believes that this was actually what Stilicho was up to, but at the time, it was an easily believable rumor. Malleable Honorius listened intently to these accusations and decided to buy into them hook, line, and sinker. Before Stilicho was even out of Italy, his enemies in the West had already turned the emperor against him. In August 408, Honorius and his court, sans Stilicho, traveled to Pavia to inspect the troops. Upon their arrival, Olympias set to work spinning more treacherous tales of Stilicho's treachery to the rank-and-file soldiers. Added to the rumor that Stilicho was neglecting his responsibilities because he was busy trying to take over the Eastern Empire, was the more immediately offensive rumor that Stilicho planned to put Alaric in charge of the war against Constantine, which was too much for the Roman troops to bear. When everyone was good and riled up, Olympias gave the signal, and a full-blown mutiny broke out. Honorius fled to the safety of his imperial residence, but most of the high-ranking officers in the army, all allies of Stilicho, were tracked down and killed by the mob. Stilicho was in Bologna when the mutiny broke out, and he immediately recognized what had happened. Olympias had turned the regular Roman forces against him, which meant that Olympias was now almost certainly in control of Honorius. At that moment, Stilicho only had auxiliary forces available to him, a Hunnic bodyguard, and the Goths who had come over after the Battle of Verona. If he contemplated using them to reassert his power, he didn't contemplate it for long. Using barbarians to attack regular Roman forces, who were under Honorius's personal banner no less, wasn't going to win him any friends. When it became clear that Stilicho was hesitating, and that this might be the end for the Vandal general, the Gothic general Sarus withdrew with his forces to see how events played out, a move that likely saved his own life and position in the post-Stilicho purges. Now thoroughly isolated, Stilicho traveled to Ravenna to await the return of the imperial court. If he was able to meet with Honorius, he might be able to talk sense to the boy, but if he could not, and this really was his time, he was apparently determined not to make a messy play for his life. The empire was weak enough. Another civil war wasn't in anyone's interest. Stilicho took refuge in a church, but pretty soon imperial soldiers came knocking. They had a letter stating that Stilicho was to be taken into custody. After being promised that their refugee was not going to be harmed, the priest stepped aside, and Stilicho was led away. But as soon as the company passed the threshold of the church, the captain of the guard pulled out another letter, this one stating that for crimes against the state, Stilicho was to be executed at once. The few retainers left with the Vandal general tried to protest, but their master waved them off. He knew that his time had come. On August 22nd, 408, Stilicho was beheaded. He was 49 years old and had more or less been the ruler of the Western Empire for the last 13 years. Stilicho was among the last truly capable leaders of the Western Empire, and though his policies were at times controversial, they should all be seen as the work of a man trying to hold together a disintegrating empire with limited resources and enemies in every direction. Aside from his obsession with controlling the Eastern court, Stilicho scrupulously maintained a pragmatic approach to war and politics, and he succeeded for more than a decade, while his counterparts in the East rose and fell with the seasons. He was not a perfect leader, and I don't think his actions were always as noble and idealistic as some have made them out to be. But if you're going to have a guy utterly dominating a weak emperor the way that Stilicho utterly dominated Honorius, oh man, you could do so much worse. Next week, we will see just how much worse you can do. Because the minute Stilicho's head was separated from his body, it became clear to everyone just how many balls the Vandal general had been personally juggling. Anti-barbarian racism that Stilicho had kept in check is about to rise to the surface, which will drive all those carefully cultivated auxiliary forces into the waiting arms of Alaric. Petty personal squabbles will then lead to a breakdown of civility between Ravenna and the Goths, which will lead to another invasion, which will then lead to the first sacking of Rome in 800 years. Hello, and welcome to the History of Rome, episode 163, Theodosius's Walls. We've spent the last 2 weeks focused primarily on the Western Empire during the first decade of the 400s AD. So before we just keep barreling along into the sack of Rome and the fall of Constantine III, I want to double back and bring the Eastern Empire up to speed. But, just so you know, as soon as we're caught up, we're going to head right back to the west because, really, that's where all the action is right now. The thing to understand about the eastern half of the empire in the years after Theodosius' death is that though the eastern court was far less stable politically than the Stilicho-led western court, the eastern provinces as a whole were far more stable than the western provinces as a whole. The population migrations brought on by the Hunnic advance onto the Hungarian plain tended to drive displaced local barbarian tribes west rather than south, which meant, as we saw last week, that the western provinces wound up dealing with the consequences of those disruptive migrations. On top of that, Sassanid Persia had been peaceful since signing a treaty with Theodosius back in the 380s, a treaty that Stilicho helped broker. So the Eastern legions could afford to focus on deflecting those barbarian migrations west instead of allowing them to come south. Indeed, in just a minute, Constantinople and the Sassanids will renew their peaceful terms, and that renewal will further stabilize the Eastern provinces, both because it meant the Romans didn't have to pour resources into fighting the Persians, but also because it meant the lucrative trade routes to and from Asia remained open for business. As we've seen, in the late 390s and early 400s, the Emperor Arcadius was dominated by a shifting cast of ministers and generals who focused on winning and holding power at least as much as they focused on actually governing the Eastern Empire. The only permanent political presence during these years was the Empress Eudoxia, whose influence over her husband never wavered while all these ministers rose and fell around her. In fact, the only real challenge to her authority came not from some ambitious prefect or powerful general, but from an incorruptible clergyman who had risen to become Bishop of Constantinople, John Chrysostom, also known as John the Golden Mouth. Though he would never achieve the same sort of political success that Ambrose of Milan had achieved, there were two critical similarities between the two men. First, both were fearless when it came to challenging imperial authority, and second, both were wildly popular with the masses. John tended towards a vow of poverty form of Christianity, and early in his life he had gone so far as to spend a few years living as an ascetic hermit. After nearly dying from his self-imposed deprivations, John returned to civilization and began preaching. He liked to use simple language to teach practical interpretations of scripture, rather than using highfalutin rhetoric to teach snooze-inducing abstract philosophy, and he quickly became a favorite of the common people. Because of this popularity, John was tapped to become Bishop of Constantinople in 398, but at first he refused. He genuinely did not want to get caught up in the trappings of power that came along with such an important office. But when pressed, he relented, though he refused to temper his beliefs in any way. He was unapologetic about denouncing the extravagant lifestyles enjoyed by the ruling elite, and one of his favorite targets became Eudoxia, who was similarly unapologetic about said extravagant lifestyle. Pretty soon, the bishop's constant hammering began to have an effect, and the popularity of the empress fell precipitously. So in 403, Eudoxia finally decided she had had enough of this gadfly bishop, and so she organized a church council whose sole purpose was to oust John and replace him with someone more agreeable. But the empress underestimated John's popularity, and when the council completed its task and John was dumped from the bishopric, unrest, bordering on riots, broke out across Constantinople. Plus, on the very night that John was taken into imperial custody in advance of his expected banishment, an earthquake struck, which almost everyone, including the empress herself, took to be a sign of God's displeasure with how they had treated the bishop. He was released from custody and reinstated to his position at once. This brush with exile dampened John's spirit not at all. The very next year, a silver statue of Eudoxia was erected near the bishop's church, which sent him straight to the pulpit to denounce both the empress and her shiny new statue. This would prove to be the last straw, and when Eudoxia and her allies moved against John this time, there was no earthquake to make them think twice. The bishop was exiled from Constantinople, and despite a concerted campaign to recall him, he never would return. Unfortunately for the empress, though, she would not have long to enjoy an uncritiqued life of luxury, because in mid-404, she died suddenly of a pregnancy-related infection. Though it's really not polite to dance on anyone's grave, objectively speaking, it's hard not to see Eudoxia's death as a net positive for the empire, because it cleared room for the new Praetorian prefect, Flavius Anthemius, to rise up and seize hold of power. Without a jealous empress around to potentially stab him in the back, Anthemius was able to dominate the eastern emperors for the next decade, first Arcadius and then Theodosius II, and see to it that the empire was run with a consistent competence it had not enjoyed in years. Not only that, but Anthemius is more or less personally responsible for the Byzantine Empire holding out as long as it did, because as soon as he came to power, the prefect initiated one of the most important construction projects in world history, the building of the Theodosian Walls. Now, I have had the good fortune to stand atop the Theodosian Walls on three separate occasions, and I can tell you straight up that there is a reason Constantinople was simply invulnerable to overland assaults. When you approach the fortification line, there is a short initial wall to trip up you and your siege engines. That short wall stands in front of the much larger outer wall, which stands about 8 meters tall. Behind that much larger wall are huge towers about 20 meters tall that would be able to rain hell and damnation down on your head while you struggle valiantly to get over the top of the 8-meter wall. But once you're over the top of the 8-meter wall, the reality of your situation would have hit you full in the face, because about 20 meters beyond the 8-meter wall was an even larger wall about 12 meters tall. All you've managed to do is plop yourself down in a no-man's-land trench filled with mud and debris that would stick you in place while the soldiers on top of the even bigger inner wall and the guard towers rained further hell and damnation down on your head. No one got out of that pit of despair alive. The Theodosian walls would be completed around 414, during the reign of young Theodosius II, hence the name, and for the next 1,000 years, they would repel every attempt to take Constantinople by land. It took the invention of the cannon, and then the construction of literally the biggest cannon ever built by humans, to finally break through. I've posted some pictures that we took of the walls during the first set of History of Rome tours up at thehistoryofrome.typepad.com. Honestly, my heart goes out to every foot soldier ever ordered by some megalomaniacal general to attack the Theodosian walls. With the physical defense of the capital city taken care of, Anthemius then turned his attention to broader security concerns. As I just mentioned, historically speaking, the biggest threats to the Eastern Empire always came from the direction of Persia, first from the Parthians and then from the Sassanids. With the Huns now moving decisively onto the Hungarian plain, where they would pose a permanent threat to the northern border, Anthemius knew that any kind of conflict with the Sassanids would be disastrous. The Huns already posed enough of a threat that Anthemius had ordered a humongous wall built to guard Constantinople. If troops ever had to be peeled off to fight in Syria, I mean, that could have been the ballgame right there. So Anthemius sent envoys to the Sassanid court and very respectfully renewed the terms that had kept the two empires at peace for the last generation. In other words, at just the right moment, Constantinople fell under the sway of an eminently practical man who did not suffer any trumped-up delusions of grandeur. He was not petty, he did not make politics personal, and he didn't appear to have much of an agenda beyond protecting and serving the empire. What made Anthemius' arrival so perfectly timed was the fact that Arcadius wound up dying on his watch in 408. As we've seen ad nauseum, transitions of imperial power can be times fraught with danger, and even though an heir was in place, that heir was just 7 years old. So opportunists of every shape and size were sharpening their long knives and getting ready to make their move, but with Anthemius firmly entrenched in power, the transition from Arcadius to the 7-year-old Theodosius II was, well, kind of anticlimactic. The prefect was able to provide a continuity of leadership and a continuity of policy that allowed the empire to move seamlessly into being ruled by a boy emperor without missing a beat. Child emperors are only as good as their regents, and not unlike Stilicho and Honorius, in Anthemius, Theodosius II had a rock-solid regent. Speaking of Stilicho, the only thing that really could have screwed up the transition of power in 408 would have been Stilicho showing up and making all kinds of noise about his own claim to power. Though I think it's a good thing that the trip never happened, it would have been kind of cool to see Stilicho and Anthemius square off in a fight for control of Constantinople. I don't particularly like Stilicho's chances, given the enormous home field advantage Anthemius would have enjoyed, but still, it would have made for some good theater. Sadly, though, Stilicho was betrayed, and then he calmly allowed himself to be beheaded in order to nobly avert a civil war, which I suppose was pretty good theater, too. Okay, so that brings us back up to where we left off last week. The East is now in the capable hands of Anthemius, while the West is presently falling into the bungling hands of Stilicho's successors. The bungling got started right away when Olympias, the minister who had undermined Stilicho to death, decided to give in to the absolute worst impulses of his age. You'll recall that both the Italian nobility and the rank-and-file foot soldiers of the regular Roman army had been none too pleased about Stilicho's pro-barbarian policies, which were really just an extension of Theodosius's pro-barbarian policies, by the way. They didn't like taking orders from barbarian officers, they didn't like using gold to buy the support of barbarian kings, and they really, really didn't like Alaric and his Goths. With Stilicho out of the way, Olympias just went ahead and let all this irrational hatred off its leash. When Radagaisus was defeated in 406, those 12,000 Gothic warriors who were incorporated into Stilicho's army brought their families along with them. Essentially, their wives and children were exempted from being sold into slavery. These Gothic families were then split up and settled across dozens of Italian municipalities, partly to give them a place to live, but partly to act as hostages to keep the men in line. In the late summer 408, Olympius announced that the presence of Gothic families in Italian cities would no longer be tolerated. So, did he ask them nicely to leave? Did he send soldiers to forcibly eject them? No, he put out an order that they were all to be slaughtered. Literally, I want you to murder every Gothic woman and every Gothic child you can find. Whatever good Olympius thought this insanely cruel order would accomplish, and he must have thought it would accomplish something good, the only lasting impact it had was to drive those 12,000 warriors right out of the Roman camp. With Italy momentarily consumed by genocidal chaos, the Goth warriors abandoned their posts and marched straight for the one man who could offer them asylum, Alaric. In a flash, the Gothic king went from potentially marginalized figure in a post-Stilicho geopolitical world back to major player. Also in a flash, the Roman army lost 12,000 soldiers. Genocide is as morally reprehensible a thing as exists in the world, but rarely does it so immediately blow up in the face of the perpetrators. Really, the massacre of the Goth families was just so unbelievably stupid, I'm kind of at a loss for words. Alaric wasted no time seizing the day, and with the enthusiastic backing of his new revenge-minded recruits, he immediately marched them and the rest of his army over the Alps into Italy. With the regular Roman forces mostly prepared for the coming offensive against Constantine in Gaul, Alaric was able to pass into Italy without so much as an arrow being shot in his direction. Plus, with the addition of Radagaisus's Goths, Alaric now led an army comparable numerically to the Roman forces stationed at Pavia. Beating the Goths in battle now was by no means a sure thing, so the Roman high command couldn't take the risk of a direct confrontation. I mean, what if they lost? During Alaric's first invasion of Italy, he had kept mostly to the northern edges of the home province, since that's where the military and political centers of the Western Empire now were. But this time, he decided to play a more psychologically terrifying card. Bypassing Aquileia and Ravenna and Milan, Alaric led his Goths due south on a beeline directly for Rome. Now at this point, Alaric had absolutely no intention of sacking the Eternal City. His plan was to simply set up a blockade, make demands, and wait for the Senate to cave, which he did, and which they then did. Alaric surrounded the city, preventing all food and supplies from entering Rome, and then demanded 5,000 pounds of gold, 30,000 pounds of silver, and all manner of silks and linens and furs to clothe his people. He also demanded the release of the 40,000 odd Goths who had been sold into slavery following Radagaisus' defeat. Not that he really needed to stand firm on that last point. As soon as Alaric entered Italy, most of the recently enslaved Goths just walked away from their new masters and joined his army. The Senate deemed the blockade obviously unbreakable and agreed to meet all of Alaric's demands. The slaves freed, the Senate humiliated, and the Goths now struggling under the weight of 35,000 pounds of precious metal, Alaric called off the blockade and return north to negotiate further concessions from Honorius. Now, the thing we must keep in mind about Alaric is that despite any preconceptions we might have about him being some rampaging barbarians because of the fact that, yes, he is about to sack Rome, this whole adventure, the invasion, the blockades, and eventually the sack itself, were all just part of his larger struggle with the Western court for political recognition. At no point was Alaric engaged in some attempt to destroy the Roman Empire. just the opposite. What he wanted more than anything else was a legitimate place for himself and his people within the Roman Empire. In initiating the blockade, he was demonstrating how powerful he now was. And in breaking off the blockade, he was demonstrating that he was fully capable of bargaining in good faith. So when he met with Honorius's agents in late 408 and early 409, he had every reasonable hope that an agreement could be reached, that the Romans would grant some sort of territorial independence to the Goths in Illyria, where they would be safe from future genocidal massacres, and that Alaric would once again be made a high-ranking general in the Roman army. But Honorius was still under the sway of the suicidally anti-barbarian Olympias, and so the negotiations went nowhere. Frustrated that the emperor did not seem to have gotten the message, in early 409 Alaric marched back to Rome and blockaded the city a second time. The people of Rome offered no resistance, and the cowed Senate seemed positively eager to help Alaric get what he wanted out of Honorius, because otherwise he was just going to keep showing up on their doorstep. While Alaric was once again encamped outside Rome, Honorius and his ministers took steps to ensure that they would be able to focus exclusively on the Gothic question, at least for the next little while. Headquartered up in Arles in Gaul, the usurper Constantine III was delighted when he opened up a package from Honorius one day in the spring of 409 and found that it contained a purple cloak, a clear signal that Ravenna now recognized Constantine's claim to Imperium over Gaul and Britain. In the great back and forth of imperial politics, Constantine had just been surpassed by Alaric as the greater threat, and so he suddenly got what he had been asking for the last 2 years. With the northern frontier temporarily free from the threat of invasion, Ravenna then turned its attention back to the question of Alaric and received an embassy of senators from Rome to help them talk through the issue. The senators, obviously, recommended that Honorius grant Alaric's demands. "We don't like it any more than you do, but the Goths are just too strong at the moment. This is no time to get pig-headed." So when Alaric came back north to resume negotiations, things went a bit smoother. This time, the two sides agreed in principle to political independence for the Goths in Illyria, as well as an annual stipend of gold and grain to keep them happy and fed. But Honorius refused to yield on the point of giving Alaric an official position in the Roman military. Talks looked like they were about to break down again when Alaric shocked everyone by suddenly abandoning almost everything he had been asking for. Gone was the request for an independent Gothic state in Illyria. Gone were the payments of gold, and gone was the military commission. Instead, Alaric came back with a simple proposal. "Let us go live along the Danube border in Noricum. Send us enough grain to help keep us fed, and we'll live in peace and defend the frontiers for you." In his excellent book, The Fall of the Roman Empire, Peter Heather speculates that this sudden about-face was driven by Alaric's long-range sensors, which picked up on the fact that though the Romans were weak now, they would not be weak forever. Take them to the cleaners today, and they may come back tomorrow when they're strong again, and take it all back with interest. But ask them for only a few supplies and the right to live in peace, and the Romans might consider us friends forever. Everyone expected the deal to go through. I mean, why wouldn't it? But at the 11th hour, Ravenna rejected all terms and broke off negotiations. There's probably something that explains this otherwise inexplicable rejection of what appears to be a criminally good deal for Rome, but we don't seem to have it. Alaric promised to go away for a song, and Honorius refused to sing. So Alaric packed his bags and headed back to Rome for the third time. When he got there, he decided to up the ante. He picked an amenable and influential senator of Greek origin named Priscus Attalus, and had the Senate proclaim their colleague Augustus of the Western Empire. If Honorius wasn't even going to pretend to play ball, then it was time to ditch him and recognize a whole new emperor, one who would actually listen to reason. So now there were three rival imperial courts in the West. Constantine III up in Arles, who was backed by a mix of regular troops and barbarian allies. Honorius in Ravenna, who was backed by some palace guards and the swamps of Ravenna. And Priscus down in Rome, backed by Alaric and his Goths. Next time, we will throw them all into the octagon to see who winds up being the last man standing. I say next time because the holidays are upon us once again, and as usual, I'm going to take the next 2 weeks off for Christmas and New Year's and all the jam-packed family fun contained therein. But we'll be back on January the 8th for the sack of Rome, the rise of Attila, and the rest of the rocket sled ride into the abyss. Before we go, though, I should also mention that a few spots have opened up on the History of Rome's next tour in March, so if someone's been asking you what you want for Saturnalia, I'm just saying that would be a pretty awesome present. Okay, happy Saturnalia to you all, and I'll see you next year. Hello, and welcome to the History of Rome, Episode 164, The Sack of Rome. Okay, where were we? When we left off last time, the Western Roman Empire was in the middle of a diplomatic crisis. The Gothic King Alaric had spent the last year holding the city of Rome's head underwater, letting it up to breathe for a bit, before plunging it back underwater again, as a part of a larger strategy to force the Emperor Honorius to give in to his demands. But Honorius had apparently concluded that since it wasn't his head in the bucket, he was under no immediate pressure to make a deal with the Goths, even if, as we saw at the end of the last episode, the deal on the table was a really, really good deal for Rome. So we now find Alaric presently back in Rome, holding the city's collective head underwater once again, this time with the added twist of forcing the Senate to appoint a puppet emperor named Priscus Attalus. Alaric was probably hoping that the people of Italy would take note of how disconnected from reality Honorius had become, how much his intransigence threatened their lives and property, and how much better off they would be maybe recognizing the Goth-backed Attalus, rather than continuing to support the isolated and delusional Honorius. I say the people of Italy, rather than the people of the Western Empire, because, as you'll also recall, control of the northern provinces had been lost back in 406, first to the semi-anarchy that had set in after the barbarian invasion of New Year's Eve, and then to the semi-imperial order of the usurper Constantine III. Not that he was actually a usurper anymore. Alaric's presence in Italy had forced Honorius to recognize Constantine as a legitimate imperial colleague. But if you thought that this recognition would prove to be a boon to the fortunes of Constantine III, well, you just don't know the 5th century. Just a few months after receiving a purple cloak in the mail from Honorius, Constantine had to deal with a rebellion of his own. This new rebellion had its genesis in a previous rebellion that had been organized in Spain by members of the Theodosian household back in 408. Constantine had dispatched his son Constans and one of his top generals, Gerontius, to put down this revolt, which, the Theodosians not being the most popular family on the block these days, they were able to do fairly quickly. Constans then returned to his father's headquarters at Arles, leaving Gerontius in control of Spain. Unfortunately, the general's ego swelled considerably at the sight of his newfound autonomy, and he decided to challenge Constantine's rule by arranging for his troops to elevate a local Spanish noble named Maximus to the rank of Augustus. As if that was not bad enough, Constantine found out about this little rebellion at the same time he found out that a group of still hostile barbarians had broken through the defensive lines keeping them penned into Gaul, and they were now crossing into Spain unchecked. Now, you might think that this would be a good thing for Constantine. You know, make Gerontius deal with the barbarians, get two enemies to fight each other, and then swoop in and knock out the exhausted victor. But sadly, rather than fight, the two sides joined forces. Gerontius was apparently able to get through to these tribes where Constantine had failed, so rather than grinding each other down into dust, each reinforced the other. Now facing an almost certain attack from the direction of Spain, Constantine was further dismayed to learn that the province of Britannia, which had been the cradle of his own rebellion, was now breaking off ties with him as well. After Constantine had left with almost all the available Roman forces, the island had come under heavy attack by Saxon pirates. Since Constantine appeared disinterested in their plight, in late 409 the people of Britain ejected Constantine's few remaining officials and took the defense and governance of their island into their own hands. Just that spring, Constantine III had been the recognized and legitimate ruler of the entire northwest quadrant of the Roman Empire. Now, he was surrounded by enemies, defending an ever smaller patch of grass in the middle of Gaul. Over the winter of 409-410, Constantine meditated on his ever-worsening position and resolved to make one last high-risk play to salvage the situation. When spring came, he was going to invade Italy and depose Honorius. He had been in contact with members of the Ravenna court who were thoroughly dissatisfied with the emperor, and they had encouraged Constantine to march across the Alps and topple him from power. As soon as the passes thawed, Constantine was on the move. Now, unfortunately for us, the details of this campaign are sketchy, and all we really know is that the invasion failed. Honorius had been reinforced by troops from the east, helpfully provided by the eastern prefect Anthemius, who had every reason to want Honorius to remain in power, which, combined with the fact that Constantine's own force could not have been that large, it was probably enough to send the general scurrying back to Arles. Meanwhile, down in Rome, Alaric was having problems of his own. He had made Priscus Attalus Augustus for two basic reasons. First, to gain leverage in his negotiations with Honorius, and second, to have a puppet civil official on the throne who would do what Alaric told him to do. Attalus was failing him on both fronts. Honorius seemed more resistant than ever to negotiations, especially after successfully repelling Constantine, and far from acting as a mere puppet, Attalus was challenging and resisting Gothic commands, most especially on the question of North Africa. Alaric wanted Attalus to cross over and seize control of the all-important grain supply chain, which Attalus was fine with, but not if it meant using Gothic forces. Attalus did not like the optics of using foreigners to seize Roman territory. If he was going to do it, he was going to use regular Roman forces to do it, which would at least give the operation a veneer of legal dignity. But of course, Attalus didn't have sufficient regular forces available to pull off the operation, so his refusal to use the Goths meant that he was refusing to go seize North Africa. Annoyed that his creation was frustrating rather than facilitating his plans, Alaric unceremoniously deposed Attalus in early 410. But don't worry, kids, we haven't heard the last of Priscus Attalus. So now Alaric was back to square one. And to make matters worse, there had been a power shift up in the Ravenna court that did not bode well for the Gothic king. Olympius, the man who had engineered Stilicho's execution, had fallen from favor, and he had been replaced by Sarus, the Gothic general who had defected to Rome's banner following the Battle of Verona in 402. This was a rotten development for Alaric, because where Olympius had stymied negotiations because of a general anti-barbarian bias, Sarus is about to stymie negotiations because of a specific hatred of Alaric. Their two families had been rivals within the Gothic community for I don't even know how long. And after the defeat at Verona, Sarus had taken the opportunity to throw his lot in with Rome rather than continue to take orders from the hated and now beaten Alaric. So if Alaric thought he'd had trouble extracting concessions from Honorius before, well, now that his blood enemy Sarus had the emperor's ear, there was no chance of anything ever getting done. Alaric pressed on, however, and in midsummer he was back in North Italy to resume negotiations with Ravenna. When these talks appeared to be progressing, Sarus used his authority as commander of the emperor's troops to destroy any and all goodwill between the two sides. Without warning, he ordered his troops to attack a contingent of Alaric's army. Nothing came of the battle, and it did not drive the two sides into open war, but it did convince Alaric that talking was officially hopeless. He was never going to get anywhere he wanted to go by remaining at the bargaining table. It was time to act. So he withdrew back to Rome and placed it under siege for the third time in just over a year. But this time, it was not a negotiating tactic. He was not waiting for the Senate to buy him off. No, this time he was going all in. The Goths were going to sack Rome. As the siege began, the first major prize of the assault fell into Alaric's lap. Gallia Placidia, the youngest daughter of Theodosius and one-time fiancé of Stilicho's now-dead son Eucarius, had been living in Rome following Olympias's coup, and when this much more serious siege began, she attempted to flee the city. Captured by Gothic soldiers, she became a highly valuable hostage to the Gothic cause. As we will see, Placidia's stay with the Goths would not be temporary, and it would be a full decade before she was released back into the custody of the Ravenna court. But fear not, she was no passive hostage. Her capture in 410 was simply the beginning of a remarkable political career that will see her first influencing and then outright directing Roman state policy until her death in 450. We will have much more to say about good Gallia Placidia as we move forward. So, welcome to the stage, Your Highness. Which brings us to, yes, here we are. Way back in episode 10, Barbarians at the Gates, we discussed the sacking of Rome by Brennus and his long-haired Gauls. When it was all over, I noted that it would be some 800 years before Rome was sacked again. Well, here we are, 800 years and 170-odd episodes later, on the extreme opposite end of the bell curve of Rome's power. On August the 24th, 410 AD, slaves inside Rome opened the Salarian Gate, allowing Alaric and his Goths to come flooding into the city. The Roman city militia, just enough to man the impressive Aurelian walls, had no hope of standing against the Goths in open combat. For the first time in almost a millennium, Rome was helpless and at the mercy of an enemy. But interestingly, there was mercy to be had. As I've mentioned in passing, Alaric's sack of Rome was not an unrestrained anarchic affair. At this point, both the sacking Goths and the sacked Romans were Christians of one sort or another, so Alaric declared churches and religious artifacts to be off-limits. And further, he sent out word to the citizens of the city that anyone taking refuge in a church would be left alone. Blood would not be spilled in the houses of God. But beyond that, well, this was an exercise in punitive plundering, so something's got to be fair game, and indeed, most things were. The wealth of the lavish homes and old imperial residences were stripped, stuffed into bags, and carted off. Citizens caught out of designated safe areas were beaten, raped, and killed. The old pagan temples were looted without compunction, and it is with a heavy heart that I report that this is the moment when the ashes of Augustus, Hadrian, and so many other great imperial figures, which had been kept safe for centuries inside of their mausoleums, were toppled and scattered to the winds of time. For 3 days, the Goths ran amok on a destructive treasure hunt that saw the best of classical Rome looted, broken, or lost. Now, the sack of Rome was no great strategic blow to the empire in military terms. Politically, it did not signal the end of the old imperial order, and in terms of the decline and fall of the Western Empire as a whole, it was more milepost than destination. But that does not mean that it was not a major blow to the citizens of the empire at the time. Morale had been wavering for years, and the thought of barbarians pillaging the Eternal City was so inconceivable that when it happened, a sort of confused despair seemed to settle in. The psychological shockwaves were strong enough that it drove St. Augustine, the bishop of the North African port of Hippo, to begin writing The City of God, a massive political and religious treatise defending Christianity from the increasingly pervasive view that Rome had been sacked because it had abandoned its pagan heritage. Augustine did not dwell on religious cause and effect, so much as he argued that everyone was missing the point. We ought to be dedicating ourselves to the eternal and non-corporeal City of God, as revealed through the divine incarnation of Father, Son, and Holy Spirit, rather than fretting about what happens to the base and worldly City of Man. This call not to save Rome, but to look past it, was a powerful comfort to a population facing what looked an awful lot to them like the end of the world. When published, The City of God almost immediately became the official political platform of the Catholic Church, and it maintained that undisputed place until St. Thomas Aquinas came along in the 1200s and offered his Aristotelian revisions. Meanwhile, back in the City of Man, the Goths had reached their load limit after 3 days of looting, and Alaric led his men out of Rome laden with treasure. As the barbarian masses disappeared over the southern horizon, the people of the Eternal City were left to pick up the pieces of their shattered city. Some resolved to stay and rebuild, but most looked at the trash shops and broken homes and asked, "Why bother?" Refugees began to stream out of Rome, beginning a cycle of economic depression, exodus, further economic depression, and further exodus that would in time take Rome from a population high of perhaps 1 million people down to a low of just 20,000 during the Middle Ages. After rocking the Roman world by sacking its most sacred city, though, Alaric did not dwell on the place he had just earned for himself in history. He was already on to the next big thing. The sack of Rome had gotten him a lot of stuff, but it had not gotten him the peace, security, or power that he was really looking for. If threatening and then looting Rome had not been enough to shake Honorius out of his stubborn stupor, then maybe cutting off the Italian food supply would be. The Gothic king led his people south to the toe of the peninsula of Italy, where he planned to launch an invasion of North Africa. Seizing the African grain supply had long been on Alaric's to-do list, and after failing to push Attalus into doing his dirty work for him, Alaric decided to take matters into his own hands. But the cobbled-together Gothic fleet of mostly stolen ships hit a storm almost as soon as they launched, and they were forced back to the safety of the Italian harbors. While the Goths regrouped and planned their next move, they were hit with a further and potentially more debilitating setback. In the autumn of 410, Alaric caught a fever, and he died. He was in his early 40s and was just months removed from the signature event that would ensure his name was and will be seared into the history books for all time. Fearful that their dead leader's body would be desecrated if left out in the open, the Goths diverted the course of a nearby river, buried Alaric in the dry bed, and then returned the stream to its natural course. Neither Alaric's body nor the hoard of treasure that would have presumably been buried with him was ever found. Control of the Goths fell to Alaric's brother Ataulf, who will lead them for the next 5 tumultuous years, as they marched from Italy to Gaul and from Gaul to Spain, making, breaking, and then remaking alliances along the way, as the Western Roman world, sometimes violently and sometimes diplomatically, reshaped itself. The geographic center of that reshaping would be Gaul, where the political and military power of the Western Empire was about to fracture still further, before being cobbled back together by a dour general who history has come to know as Constantius III. Constantius was of Illyrian origin, and likely came up through the ranks of Theodosius's post-Adrianople Eastern legions before, like Stilicho, following the emperor west to put down the revolt of Eugenius and Arbogast. He doesn't really pop into recorded history until 411, though, so it is simply an educated guess that his career followed an arc similar to Stilicho's, to whom it is also educatedly guessed Constantius was a loyal subordinate of. In 411, though, he had risen high enough that Honorius appointed him to the task of finally taking down Constantine III, who was presently back in Gaul, holding down that ever-shrinking patch of grass from his headquarters in Arles. But as Constantius readied the Italian army for war with Constantine, word came down that things had become a wee bit more complicated. The general Gerontius had finally launched his expected attack from Spain, and after defeating a division of Constantine's forces near modern Vienne, he had moved on to Arles and put the city to siege. So now Constantius was facing two hostile armies in the same place at the same time. To get to Constantine, he would have to go through Gerontius. Rather than wait for the two enemy armies to wear each other out, however, Constantius decided to aggressively move in and attack Gerontius while he was still occupied with his siege. This proved to be a winning strategy, because Gerontius's disunited army of barbarians and regular Roman forces panicked at the first sight of Constantius's army, and most of Gerontius's men chose to desert to the approaching Italian army rather than fight a battle trapped against the walls of Arles. Abandoned by his troops, Gerontius fled, but he appears to have been tracked down and cornered by Spanish soldiers from his own ex-army and likely killed himself after becoming trapped. Back in Arles, the breaking of Gerontius's army had done nothing to improve the situation for Constantine, however, as Constantius simply stepped in and resumed the siege. Constantine's only hope was that Frankish reinforcements from the Lower Rhine would arrive in time to lift the siege. But, though said reinforcements did arrive in time, Constantius simply drove them off, which is not so good if that was your only hope. And indeed it was. When Constantine desperately called for reinforcements a second time, the call was ignored by the soldiers remaining in the Lower Rhineland. They were no dummies. They could see which way the winds were blowing. Constantine was now on his own. Constantius sent a note into the city promising that if Constantine ended his resistance and handed himself over, that he would be allowed to live. Recognizing that his position was hopeless, Constantine agreed to the terms and surrendered. But as was so often the case in these situations, Constantius's deal was just a ruse to lure Constantine out of the city, and the captured general was executed while on the road from Arles to Ravenna. Okay, so that's it then, right? Constantius has come along, saved the day, and defeated all existing enemies of the imperial throne. The Western Empire is now back under the united control of Ravenna, right? Oh, would that it were so. But as Arles was falling, a new usurper appeared along the Lower Rhine. The forces gathered there, dominated by a mix of Franks, Burgundians, and Alans, had been aligned with Constantine until they stopped returning his phone calls. When it became clear that their patron was going down, they grabbed a local Gallic noble named Jovinus and hailed him as Augustus in the city of Mainz. Like an oversized game of whack-a-mole, as one usurper got whacked, another popped up on the other side of the board. But before he could deal with this new usurper, Constantius was going to have to come back to Italy and deal with a more immediate problem. Ataulf and the Goths had been making their way north and were now getting a bit too close to Ravenna for anyone's comfort. So Constantius headed back across the Alps to hopefully push the Goths out of Italy once and for all. Next week, Constantius will succeed in pushing the Goths out of Italy, but rather than driving them east, back to Illyria, they will instead press on north to the newly pacified, but still fragile, southern Gaul. As you can imagine, the appearance of this Gothic horde is going to have a major impact on the precarious military and political balance of the Northwest Empire. Who will the Goths side with? Who will they then betray? And what would the ramifications be of a Gothic king, like, say, Ataulf, fathering a son with an imperial princess, like, say, Gallia Placidia? Would those ramifications be even more extreme if a childless emperor, like, say, Honorius, were to die without naming a clear heir? I think that they would. Hello, and welcome to the History of Rome. Episode 165, Reviving the Roman Name. In early 412 AD, two forces converged on northern Italy. Coming up from the south was Ataulf and the Goths, who were now more than a year removed from the sack of Rome, but still no closer to finding the permanent home or the permanent place in the Roman world that they had been searching for. Coming down from the north was Constantius III, commander-in-chief of the Western Roman army, who had just whipped two usurpers in the span of a single summer. Neither side was entirely sure what the motivations of the other were, so they gingerly skirted around each other, trying to get a feel for what the other intended to do. Were the Goths going to follow up on their sack of Rome by attacking Ravenna? Was Constantius going to go for the hat trick and press for a decisive battle? As it turned out, the answer to both of these questions was a resounding no. Ataulf was obviously interested in all the things Alaric had been interested in, a homeland for the Goths, a regular stipend for his people, and a place in the Roman military order for himself personally, but he was not particularly interested in using brute force to get there. At least not at the moment. Constantius, for his part, opened with a hard line, ordering the Goths to leave Italy immediately, but he was clearly not sitting on a hair trigger. A battle with the Goths, even a victorious battle, risked the precious military resources of the faltering Western Empire. Neither side wanted a battle, and so it was to everyone's great relief that the Goths decided to leave Italy without a fight, and Constantius decided to let them go without a fight. The man who did the most to convince Ataulf to leave Italy was, surprisingly, the deposed puppet emperor Priscus Attalus. Just because he had not worked out as an emperor did not mean that the Goths did not still value his counsel, and he had stayed on with Alaric as an advisor after the sack of Rome, and now served Ataulf in the same capacity. Ataulus pointed out to the Gothic king that southern Gaul was now not only pacified, but in the process of remaking itself politically and economically after 5 years of chaos. It would be the perfect time for the Goths to head over the Alps and stake some kind of claim for themselves. Ataulf was intrigued by the possibility of becoming a power broker in a newly reorganized Gaul, and so he ordered his people over the mountains. The departure of the Goths was a mixed blessing for Honorius and Constantius. Naturally, Ravenna was happy to see them out of Italy, But it's not like Gaul was a really super place for them to be setting up shop. Jovinus's revolt in Upper Germany was still in full swing, and if the Goths decided to join forces with the usurper, then their combined strength might overwhelm the imperial defenses. Worried about this possibility, and about the future safety of the imperial hostage Gallia Placidia, Honorius authorized a payment of gold to greet the Goths when they emerged on the far side of the Alps. Hopefully, the gold would be enough to keep the Goths at least neutral in the coming showdown with Jovinus, and keep Placidia safe until arrangements for her release could be made. But the perfunctory down payment was not enough to keep Atolf from exploring his options, and as soon as the Gothic horde entered Gaul, they opened up negotiations with Jovinus, offering their strength in exchange for all the concessions Honorius had been refusing to grant. An agreement in principle between the two sides was reached, but then Jovinus made a critical blunder. Well, actually, who knows if it was Jovinus's blunder. Though he was formally the emperor, like Priscus Attalus in Rome or Maximus in Spain before him, he was really just a puppet of the local military. In this case, the main powers behind the throne were the Burgundian king Gundahar and the Alan king Goar. So it was much more their blunder than Jovinus's, but it is less complicated to just group them all together under Jovinus's name, since he was the legal authority under which they had chosen to operate. Anyway, their collective blunder stemmed from an imperial soap opera that had played out down in Ravenna, where ever since the rise of Constantius, the Goth general Sarus had fallen from favor. This falling out was mutual, however, as Sarus was still nursing a grudge against Honorius for not properly punishing the men who had betrayed and executed Stilicho, the man who had brought Sarus over to the Roman side in the first place. Sarus was also annoyed that one of his retainers had been recently murdered, and no one seemed interested in investigating the matter properly. With the Goth incessantly complaining about the emperor's inaction, and Constantius proving himself to be an eminently capable military commander, Sarus was pushed out of the inner circle in 412. In a huff, the Goth general sent a note up to Jovinus, offering the usurper his services, and he began to march north with a group of 28 still loyal retainers. If you recall that the families of Atolf and Sarus were blood enemies, then you can probably guess what Jovinus's blunder is going to be. The puppet emperor accepted Sarus's offer of service, which immediately alienated Atolf and opened up a rift between the usurpers on the Rhine and the Goths in southern Gaul. Right at the moment when they were about to bind themselves to one another, Sarus walked into the picture like a polarized magnet and pushed everyone away from everyone else. Not that Sarus ever actually joined up with Jovinus, mind you. Atolf wasn't going to let that happen in a million years. On their way north, Sarus and his party were met by a force of Goths that Olympiodorus reports as being at least 10,000 strong, which may have been a bit of an overkill, but hey, blood enemies deserve the red carpet treatment. Sarus apparently staged a brave last stand, but you know, the outcome is never really in doubt when it's 28 against 10,000. With Sarus out of the picture, relations between Jovinus and Atolf should have improved, but the bad blood that had been generated continued to poison their relations. Shortly after Sarus's death, the barbarian kings backing Jovinus decided to elevate their puppet's brother Sebastianus to serve as co-emperor. This unilateral move to expand the imperial college without even discussing it with him offended Atolf mightily. If the Goths were going to play a meaningful role in an alliance, then they were going to have to be consulted when it came time to elevate new leaders. Already in a mood to be ticked off by the actions of Jovinus' court, Atolf was ticked off by the actions of Jovinus' court. So instead of the Goths and the Rhine armies joining forces and potentially overrunning Constantius and the imperial legions, Atolf sent a message down to Constantius, saying, "Hey, it turns out I don't like these guys any more than you do, so what say we join forces and whack them back into the Stone Age?" Constantius, who was more than happy to let the Goths take the lead in attacking Jovinus, agreed that an alliance was a mighty fine idea. So, either in the autumn of 412 or the spring of 413, Ataulf and the Goths advanced north to confront the forces of Jovinus and Sebastianus. And by that, I mean, of course, the forces of Gundahar and Goar. The two sides faced off at some indeterminate location in central Gaul, and the Goths carried the day, capturing Sebastianus in the process. The junior puppet was handed over to the prefect of Gaul, who immediately had him executed. Definitely now in 413, Ataulf followed up his victory by laying siege to Jovinus at Valentia in south-central Gaul. Valentia soon fell, Jovinus was captured, and like his brother, was executed by the prefect of Gaul. The heads of both brothers were then sent down to Ravenna, where they were publicly displayed, before being sent down to the North African port of Carthage, where they were publicly displayed again to warn off anyone contemplating insurrection in the breadbasket of the Western Empire. Ataulf's quick work against Honorius's enemies re-cemented the positive working relationship between the Goths and the Romans that had been shattered by the death of Stilicho 5 years earlier. Ataulf certainly saw bright enough days ahead that on January the 1st, 414 AD, he forged a familial alliance between the two nations by marrying his imperial hostage, Gallia Placidia. Hinting at his long-term ambitions, Ataulf wed Placidia in a traditional Roman wedding, and himself wore the uniform of a high-ranking Roman general for the occasion. Like his brother before him, Ataulf was clearly angling for an official position within the Roman ranks, and as the new brother-in-law of the Western Emperor, how was he to expect anything less? Further evidence of Ataulf's intentions comes to us by way of Orosius, a contemporary, that is, contemporaneous, Christian historian who published a history of the Roman Empire in 417 or 418. In this history, he reports that upon marrying Placidia, Ataulf declared that, and I'm quoting a bit here, "At first I wanted to erase the Roman name and convert all Roman territory into a Gothic empire. I longed for Romania to become Gothia, and Ataulf to be what Caesar Augustus had been. But long experience has taught me that the ungoverned wildness of the Goths will never submit to laws, and that without law, a state is not a state. Therefore, I have more prudently chosen the different glory of reviving the Roman name with Gothic vigor, and I hope to be acknowledged by posterity as the initiator of a Roman restoration, since it is impossible for me to alter the character of this empire." Now, of course, Ataulf never actually said this. As was the case with ancient histories, the actual speech would have been written by Orosius. But it is entirely plausible that Ataulf would have said something like this. The Roman Empire was weakening by the day, but even in its current state of decay, it was still too powerful for the Goths to simply overthrow and replace with something else. It is thus reasonable to presume that Ataulf's ambitions were now firmly focused on creating a Gothic ascendancy within the framework of the empire, by way of the family he was creating with Gallia Placidia, and by way of the son she would hopefully soon bear for him. Like the Spanish nobles who took over the empire in the 2nd century, and the Illyrian generals who took it over in the 3rd century, with a little luck, the 5th century would belong to the Goths, who would give the empire just the shot in the arm it needed. The tantalizing prospect of Romanized Goths stepping in and forging a new dynasty that would rule the Western Empire and return it to its proper place of power and glory was brought remarkably close to fruition 9 months later, when Gallia Placidia gave birth to a healthy baby boy. When you look around the imperial family circa 414, you can see just how close that boy came to inheriting the empire. Honorius himself had no children, and showed no interest in ever fathering any children. His late brother Arcadius had died after fathering 4 children: the boy Theodosius II, who was currently reigning in Constantinople, and three daughters, the rising power that was Elia Pulcheria, and her two younger sisters, Arcadia and Marina, all three of whom appear to have taken a vow of virginity after their brother was made Augustus. So, not much chance of any new heirs coming anytime soon from that side of the family. Arcadius and Honorius had the one living sister, Gallia Placidia, who had thus far given birth to no children. Until now. So if Honorius were to die anytime soon, that meant that the only living male in the imperial family who was not already an emperor was the newborn son of Ataulf and Placidia, named Theodosius after his grandfather. But just as the empire seemed poised to give itself over to the Goths, the course of history suddenly shifted again. Constantius III knew darn well what the implications would be if Ataulf and the Goths wormed their way into the imperial power structure. He'd be fired from his job and most likely executed. So he convinced Honorius to sanction an offensive against the Goths, who, he assured the emperor, were up to all manner of nefarious double dealings and sinister agenda pushings. The emperor was already unhappy that the barbarian king had made a wife of his sister, and so he approved Constantius's plan to break Ataulf and the Goths, despite the good work they had just done on his behalf. Constantius got to work at once blockading the ports of Gaul with the aim of starving the Goths into submission. Shocked by this betrayal, and it was a betrayal, Ataulf renounced his alliance with Honorius and elevated yet another puppet emperor to swear his allegiance to. And since, hey, why not, he's here and still technically a Roman senator, Ataulf decided to re-elevate Priscus Attalus to the rank of Augustus. But the second reign of Priscus Attalus went no smoother than the first, and in the end it would only last for a few months. Constantius's blockade was effective enough that Ataulf decided the Goths could no longer survive in Gaul, and he led them west, across the Pyrenees, and into Hispania. Along the way, Attalus either ran away or was purposely ditched, and he was soon picked up by imperial agents. He would be kept under house arrest until he could be paraded in an official triumph in 416, after which he was exiled to a small island off the coast of Sicily. No word on whether the local birds made him emperor for a third time. It was after the Goths arrived in Barcelona in late 414 that Placidia gave birth to young Theodosius. But as 414 gave way to 415, fate delivered a cruel blow to the mother's love and the father's ambition. The infant Theodosius, half-Goth heir to the Western Empire, died in early 415. As quickly as hopes had been raised that the Goths would become the new masters of Rome, those hopes were dashed. Ataulf now presided over a harried and hungry tribe that was trapped between an imperial blockade and the Germanic tribes, among them the Vandals and Alans, who had already taken control of the best parts of the Spanish peninsula. But Ataulf did not have to fret over the plight of his people for long. After killing Sarus in 412, Ataulf had magnanimously agreed to take his blood enemy's surviving supporters into his retinue. One of them would prove to be a ticking time bomb that finally went off in 415. While Ataulf was taking a bath, this secretly revenge-minded retainer entered the chamber and murdered him. The sudden murder of their king had two major effects on the Goths. First, it sent their political order spinning into chaos, and second, it was debilitating to general morale. When Alaric had died, Ataulf was right there, ready, willing, and able to step into his brother's shoes. But when Ataulf died, there was no clear-cut replacement waiting in the wings, and so a power struggle ensued. Seeing the throne open, and resting his legitimacy on better to ask forgiveness than permission, a noble named Sigeric bypassed the usual election process and seized the crown for himself, possibly within hours of Ataulf's death. Sagaric is a doubly interesting figure, because he was the brother of Sarus, and thus came from the minority faction that had long chafed under the rule of Alaric and Atolf's families. So, this was not just a power grab, it was a power grab by the long-standing enemies of the entrenched parties. Sagaric's attempt to realign Gothic politics, however, quickly fell apart, and just 7 days after seizing the crown, he himself was assassinated and replaced by a cousin of Alaric and Atolf named Walia, or Walia. Walia, supported by the majority of the Goths in Barcelona, was able to hold on to power until his death in late 418 or early 419, a short reign that will see relations between the Romans and Goths repaired. But instead of the Goths dictating terms, as Alaric and Atolf had envisioned, Walia would be forced to accept that it would be the Romans who dictated the terms in the end. The fact that Walia could relent to Roman pressure, accept vassal status for his people, which he is about to do, and maintain his hold on power, is proof of the second great consequence of Atolf's death, that morale within the Gothic ranks was driven to pretty dismal lows. Since the death of Stilicho, they had been on a pretty good run. They had been reinforced by the remains of Radagaisus' army, laid successful siege to Rome, and then gotten paid a pretty penny to go away, came this close to forcing Honorius to give them independence and a cash stipend, sacked Rome without breaking a sweat, defeated Jovinus and Sebastianus without breaking a sweat. But suddenly, the well of good fortune had dried up. Now they were wedged into a corner of Spain, the architects of their success dead, and everyone else starving. Fortune, she is a great and terrible mistress. So one of Walia's first acts upon becoming the new king of the Goths was to open negotiations with Constantius. The Roman general announced that he was happy to lift the blockade and hand over all the grain the Goths would ever need on two conditions. First, the Goths must fight for Rome rather than for themselves, and in effect become little more than a division within the Roman army. Second, they must surrender the emperor's sister, Gallia Placidia. Walia and his advisors considered these terms and decided they could live with them. After all, we're not the ones who had given up on the alliance we formed against Jovinus. That was all on you. If you want us to fight your battles for you, that's fine. We've done it before. Just, you know, don't blockade us into submission when we're done. As to Gallia Placidia, well, she was a mighty valuable chip. But sometimes you have to cash in your mighty valuable chips to get stuff you need, like food, so that your children don't starve to death. So in 415, Walia cashed Gallia Placidia in for food. Which means that I misspoke last week when I said it would be a full decade before she was released from Gothic custody. I'm not entirely sure why I said that. It was only about 5 years. I just misread the dates, I guess. Sorry about that. Deal with the Goths in hand, Constantius knew exactly what he wanted to do with his new auxiliary army. He wanted them to retake the Spanish peninsula from those still loose barbarian squatters who had set up shop there. Wrenching back control of Spain from these tribes, mostly Alan and Vandal, was not just a matter of satisfying Roman pride or making the map look clean and pretty again. It was a matter of raw economic calculation. Their presence was disrupting the collection of taxes. Hispania had always been a well-insulated cash cow for the Western Empire, but now, suddenly, the milk had dried up. Which was a terrible development, because Spain had been just about the last steady contributor to the imperial coffers over the last few years. Italy had been ransacked by the Goths. Gaul had been overrun by barbarians in civil war, so it's not like there was a lot coming in to begin with. The loss of Spain was making the imperial position completely untenable. On top of all that, the island of Britannia was looking more and more like it was never coming back into the Roman fold. In fact, I buzzed past this last week, but historians tend to date the permanent abandonment of Britain by the Romans to 410 AD. After expelling Constantine III's officers and taking the defense of the island into their own hands, the local Britons found themselves outgunned by the incoming Saxon pirates. So they wrote to Honorius, requesting a new garrison to help protect them. Honorius replied that he could spare no resources and that Britain must look out for itself. Now, had things gone a little different, this might have wound up being merely a temporary retreat. But things didn't go different, and the Romans never did go back. It would be a few generations before cultural Romano-Britain gave way to its Anglo-Saxon successor, but politically and militarily, Britannia was lost to the empire for good. Which is why it was so important to circle the wagons and make sure that the same thing didn't happen to Spain. So next week, Constantius will direct the Goths to begin operations against the Alans and Vandals at once. The interesting thing, though, is that while the Gothic offensive will be mostly successful, it will be mostly successful against the Alans, who were, at the moment, the strongest of the barbarian tribes in Hispania. By focusing their attention correctly on the Alans, the Goth offensive will unfortunately prove to be somewhat less successful against the Vandals. And if you've read ahead, you know that the failure to crush the Vandals will wind up having fairly disastrous consequences for Rome. Because though Spain had long been an insulated cash cow for the empire, the even more insulated and even bigger cash cow had always been North Africa. What's that you say? In just a few short years, something called the Vandal Kingdom is going to appear in North Africa? That can't be good. That can't be good at all.